Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, a program for medical oncologists and urologists on the care of patients with urothelial bladder cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As a follow-up to our recent live symposium at the 2023 ASCO annual meeting, I met with Dr. Matthew Galsky from the Tisch Cancer Institute in New York City. Dr. Galsky was on the faculty of our satellite at ASCO, and to begin our discussion, I asked him to provide his perspective on the evolution of the treatment landscape of urothelial bladder cancer over the last decade.
So I think the treatment landscape has changed dramatically, of course, in the past 10 years. We had platinum-based chemotherapy 10 years ago in the neoadjuvant setting and in the metastatic setting, and that was pretty much it. And now we have immune checkpoint blockade, we have FGFR inhibition, we have two antibody drug conjugates approved in the advanced setting. We have new drugs coming into the non-muscle invasive setting. So I think it's dramatically different. I was thinking about this the other day. In any one clinic session, probably 75% of the patients that I'm seeing are getting immune checkpoint blockade right now in my practice. And that's dramatically different from the past. And a lot of time is spent either seeing patients who have been on immune checkpoint blockade for years with good disease control and minimal side effects, or trying to manage immune-related side effects.
Yeah, that really is amazing development. Well, we'll kind of get into the specifics as we go through some of the topics that we got into during the symposium. And the first one was non-muscle invasive disease. And again, if you could kind of provide a broad perspective.
Absolutely. So non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, we typically separate into papillary tumors. So those are Ta tumors and T1 tumors. T1 tumors, of course, invading the lamina propria. And then carcinoma in situ, cancer cells sort of carpeting the lining of the bladder. Those two entities are different from a genomic perspective in large part and from a behavior perspective, but they're different from an important practical perspective. Carcinoma in situ tends to carpet the lining of the bladder, and so it's not an entity that can necessarily be resected. You can resect some carcinoma in situ, but usually there's some left. And so when you do trials in a carcinoma in situ, you can actually measure response. You give a drug, and then 3 months later, 6 months later, you see if there's a response in the bladder, similar to what we do in the metastatic setting. Papillary tumors, Ta tumors, and T1 tumors are more akin to adjuvant therapy. Those tumors, you can see, they tend to be solitary, sometimes they're multiple, but they can be resected, and you can see them when they're resected. And then you give a treatment afterwards, and the endpoints are really the lack of recurrence of those tumors. And so because the endpoints are completely distinct in those two entities, typically they've had to be studied separately. And that's been done either in separate clinical trials or one clinical trial with different cohorts. The standard treatment for high-risk non-muscle invasive bladder cancer is still BCG. BCG is still the standard treatment. BCG has been difficult because of some shortages, but it still remains the standard treatment. After BCG, that's referred to with some different terminology, but BCG unresponsive disease is the most common terminology, and that has specific implications in terms of the amount of prior BCG and when cancer recurs. For BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder, currently pembrolizumab is approved by the FDA for BCG unresponsive carcinoma in situ. The trial that led to that approval had a separate cohort enrolling patients with BCG unresponsive papillary tumors. That data was reported at ASCO GU this past year, and the data is compelling. Pembrolizumab doesn't yet have a label in that indication, though. There's additional treatments being developed in this space with an approval for a drug called Instiladrin that we haven't really seen in clinical practice yet, but the drug is approved.
Could you reflect back on your experience with pembrolizumab and non-muscle invasive disease? What are the kinds of scenarios that you've encountered and what you've seen clinically? I mean, most patients, I guess, don't respond, but what do you see?
Most patients don't respond. Similar to what we see in the metastatic setting, though, when patients do respond, they tend to respond really well. and for a very long time. And so I think for a subset of patients who are amenable to an intravenous therapy in the BCG unresponsive setting, it can work quite well for a subset of patients.
And what about patients who would theoretically be eligible for the cystectomy, younger patients who are in good condition but don't want to have a cystectomy? Are you okay giving a shot at Pembro in a patient like that?
So it depends a little bit on the features of the cancer, the timing of recurrence after prior BCG, et cetera. So there is some risk stratification that can help make that decision. But yes, I think the Pembro data set supports the safety of doing that. There's some data from MD Anderson recently supporting the safety of at least one shot at additional treatment before moving on to cystectomy.
Kind of curious, of course, these patients are usually primarily managed by urologists. Do you see urologists administering Pembro?
There are some large urology practices that administer Pembro. And I think there's some different practice patterns in terms of the use of Pembro in this setting. There's a doublet chemotherapy intravesical regimen, the combination of docetaxel and gemcitabine, that's largely become a default standard treatment in this setting. There have been some single institutional series and then multi-institutional series using that regimen with compelling results. And because that's an intravesical treatment, that's been a commonly used strategy in this setting.
You were commenting on BCG. I'll ask a question I've asked a lot, and I'm still not quite sure about it, which is, I don't know if you have any hypotheses about mechanism of action.
Yeah, so I think that it's one of those therapies that there's a lot of data, but putting it all together into a unifying mechanism of action, I think is difficult. I think, you know, if you look at all the data over time, it certainly does suggest that there's an innate immune response that's triggered, followed by an adaptive immune response. But then the nuances beyond that are a little bit different from study to study.
So let's talk about some of the new things that are being looked at in these patients and others. And one that I've found really interesting is the TAR-200. Can you explain what that is?
So TAR-200 is a device. It's a silicon device that's inserted into the bladder by a urologist. It then assumes a pretzel-like shape, so it stays within the bladder. And through an osmotic gradient, it releases drug over time. So in the first instance, it releases gemcitabine. We know that intravesical gemcitabine is a treatment for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, been studied pretty extensively. And one could imagine that if you have a cytotoxic drug and you instill it into the bladder and then a patient urinates it out right after instillation, the pharmacokinetics would be quite different than a sustained release over time. And so that's the rationale, that you could improve the efficacy of drugs by improving the delivery of drugs in this setting. And the data with TAR-200 thus far is really quite interesting, really being studied across the spectrum of non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive bladder cancer.
And one of the clinical trial concepts that I find really interesting is the idea of TAR-200 plus an IO. I guess the one that's been studied is sotrelimab, which I don't think is approved. But I guess, you know, kind of if you think about it, it's kind of like chemo plus IO, which has been successful in lung cancer and so many other situations. Any thoughts about where this strategy is going to head? I know they delivered erdafitinib through TAR-200 also. Where do you see this heading in the future?
So there's clinical trials going on in the muscle-invasive bladder cancer setting to determine whether or not this could be a strategy, TAR-200 plus PD-1 blockade in patients who are otherwise not great candidates for cystectomy and otherwise chemo radiation would be considered. So I think that's a really interesting space and a space that's an unmet need. The other space that I think is interesting for TAR-200, of course, is the non-muscle invasive bladder cancer space, just based on the data that's available. So at AUA, there was preliminary data reported for TAR-200 in patients with BCG unresponsive non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. The response rates are really quite high. And so that's going to move on to the BCG naive space.
So as I mentioned, as you know, when we did the meeting at ASCO, we surveyed 75 general medical oncologists and ask them, well, what do you want us to ask the faculty? And as we go through this chat today, I'll bring up a couple questions I don't think we got a chance to answer during the actual meeting. One is the issue that somebody brought up about upper urothelial cancer and how you determine invasive and non-invasive, and how do you approach non-invasive?
So upper tract urothelial cancer, very difficult to stage based on the anatomy. Really, the distinction is low grade versus high grade, because those tumors are managed differently. For high grade tumors of the upper urothelial tract, really regardless of stage, because the staging is difficult, nephroureterectomy has generally been the standard treatment. Defining the stage with a little bit more precision in terms of understanding the application of neoadjuvant chemotherapy in that space has been another separate but related question. And so typically the presence of high-grade cytology in a mass on scan has been sufficient for enrollment on neoadjuvant trials in the upper tract space. For low-grade tumors, there are some other options, including an interesting product that's amidomycin gel that's instilled into the upper tract and then solidifies so that there's sustained presence of mitomycin in the upper tract, but that's for lower grade disease.
Any other issues in upper tract disease or questions that you get about it, including muscle invasive disease?
So I think the major issue in upper tract disease is neoadjuvant therapy or adjuvant therapy. So that's one. The second issue is related to adjuvant therapy specifically, and I'll speak to that. So neoadjuvant versus adjuvant, we have phase 3 data for adjuvant therapy, the POUT study published in The Lancet, a study that was done in the UK, and that showed a benefit of platinum-based chemotherapy versus observation in the upper tract setting. In the U.S. cooperative groups, there are a series of neoadjuvant studies that have been done. Those are single-arm studies. So we have some path CR rate data from neoadjuvant chemotherapy in the upper tract, but we have phase 3 data in the adjuvant setting. So the level of evidence currently is stronger for adjuvant therapy, although some oncologists in the United States prefer neoadjuvant therapy based on the fact that both kidneys are present and the ability to get in cisplatin-based chemotherapy might be higher in the neoadjuvant setting. The other question that comes up in the adjuvant setting is adjuvant chemotherapy versus adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade, because we really have data for both. We have the POUT study with platinum-based chemotherapy. We have CheckMate 274 with adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade. And that really, we don't have comparative data between those two, and that really just warrants a discussion with a patient, a shared medical decision.
So you mentioned neoadjuvant therapy, and maybe you can provide an update on where we are with neoadjuvant therapy, what kind of issues are being addressed in clinical trials related to neoadjuvant therapy, and in what situations do you not do neoadjuvant therapy in muscle-invasive disease?
So for muscle-invasive bladder cancer, we still think about patients who are cisplatin-eligible versus patients who are cisplatin-ineligible. For patients who are cisplatin-ineligible, we currently don't have level one evidence to support non-cisplatin-based neoadjuvant therapy. So the standard is still cystectomy to proceed with surgery alone, or chemoradiation if someone's pursuing bladder sparing. For patients who are cisplatin-eligible, then the combination of gemcitabine and cisplatin or MVAC are really considered standard treatment options. At ASCO this year, we saw the final results from the VESPER study, which was a study done in France where patients were randomized to receive neoadjuvant gemcis or dose-dense MVAC, or they could receive that in the adjuvant setting. So it was a little bit of a mixed study, neoadjuvant or adjuvant. Turns out that the majority of patients received it in the neoadjuvant setting. That study showed with a final analysis that there was a survival benefit with dose-dense MVAC compared to gemcitabine and cisplatin. The limitations in the generalizability of that study are, one, the patients were generally younger age than the average patient that we see with bladder cancer. But perhaps more importantly, that study administered 6 cycles of dose-dense MVAC versus 4 cycles of gem-cis. And it's unclear whether or not the difference in outcomes is just getting more chemotherapy. So most GU oncologists still consider these options, gemcis or dose-dense MVAC, appropriate options in the neoadjuvant setting. The current generation of studies are exploring integration of immune checkpoint blockade in the neoadjuvant setting. Most of the studies have a similar design, GemCis plus or minus immune checkpoint blockade. Those studies will see some initial data probably in the next year.
And of course, that's already approved in lung cancer, so and adjuvant, and they have a big controversy, and I don't know if that's where you guys are going to end up. Before we continue on, I have to ask you the question. I feel like I'm asking this every day, almost regardless of tumor type, which is the issue of chemotherapy shortage and how you all are dealing with it, what you see going on in the community, and any advice you have for docs.
So there's of course, a platinum shortage going on right now. At our institution, we had some guidelines in terms of which patients should be prioritized for cisplatin and carboplatin. In patients with urothelial cancer, muscle-invasive bladder cancer, of course, neoadjuvant cisplatin is a standard of care shown to have a survival benefit. This is a curative regimen, so certainly it should be prioritized if cisplatin is available. In the metastatic setting, although there's a carboplatin shortage, there is a new treatment regimen that's been approved for patients with metastatic bladder cancer, metastatic urothelial cancer, or cisplatin ineligible, and that's the combination of enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab. So having a carboplatin shortage certainly is a major issue because this is an important drug. There is an alternative option that's an FDA-approved acceptable option in this space now.
Yeah, and that really differentiates you from a lot of other solid tumors that really don't have a reasonable alternative. So we'll get to that, of course, in a second when we get to metastatic disease. But just to follow up in terms of adjuvant therapy, you presented earlier this year a follow-up from the CheckMate 274 study. Can you kind of comment on what that looked at, how the FDA reacted, and how it's being integrated into your practice?
So CheckMate 274 randomized patients to adjuvant nivolumab for a year versus adjuvant placebo for a year. The patient population included patients with bladder or upper tract tumors who had not received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and had pathological T3 or higher tumors, or patients who had neoadjuvant chemotherapy and had pathological T2 or higher tumors. The initial data was reported with a median follow-up of about 5.8 months. The most recent data was reported with a median follow-up of about 3 years, and the effect size for adjuvant nevo versus placebo for disease-free survival was really quite stable compared to the initial results. And so there is a disease-free survival benefit in the all-comer population, and in addition, in patients with tumors with high PD-L1 expression. That led to the FDA approval of adjuvant nevo in the United States, regardless of PD-L1 expression. And I think this is an approach that has been has had rapid uptake in the bladder cancer setting.
So one question I have about that study is sort of who is eligible to receive it or who should get it. The FDA looks like they lined up with the way the trial was set up, and maybe you can talk about what the criteria was. But I guess one of the questions I have is, theoretically, would you expect benefit for lower risk patients that are currently being treated? And if so, do you think that they should be, some of these people should be offered therapy if you could access it?
So I think in the adjuvant setting, we have a double biomarker problem. We don't know who needs treatment and we don't know who benefits from treatment. And oftentimes those are conflated, but they're two very different things. You could have a tumor that's exquisitely sensitive to adjuvant to immune checkpoint blockade. But if you don't have micrometastatic disease, you could give that patient all the immune checkpoint blockade in the world. They're not going to benefit. And so we need tools to define both. So far, we don't have those tools. PD-L1 expression in CheckMate 274 is compelling, but patients benefited even with low PD-L1 expression. So I don't think we can necessarily use that, and it's not in the label. ctDNA testing, very compelling based on the IMvigor 210 data. And so that's something that's being prospectively validated. I think in the future, having tests to determine who needs treatment, we're going to be much closer to that than determining actually who benefits from treatment. And what I mean specifically is ctDNA to make those decisions.
Well, when you think of, so, for example, what, you know, in a patient who's had neoadjuvant therapy, would they need to be, what would you need to see at surgery in order to be treated?
So pathological T2 or higher, that was the eligibility criteria. We know that pathological T2 tumors in the setting of prior neoadjuvant chemotherapy, obviously less high risk than a T3 or a T4 tumor, but that residual cancer, despite exposure to prior chemotherapy, is telling us something biologically, and that's associated with a fairly high risk of recurrence and certainly justifies consideration of adjuvant therapy.
So if a patient with a T2 tumor post-op said, what's my chance of having a relapse without any further therapy, what would you say?
Yeah, it's about 40 to 50%.
And if they had a T1 residual tumor, what would you say?
Yeah, so then it's certainly lower, and those patients weren't included in the study. And so we generally would not recommend adjuvant therapy in that setting.
But I'm just curious, what would you tell the patient in terms of chance of relapse?
So T1 tumor after prior neoadjuvant chemotherapy, mm-hmm. Maybe about 10 to 20%.
And, you know, theoretically, if you knew that the hazard rate applied going down, that would end up with potentially, 5 or 10% absolute avoidance of recurrence. Do you think that there are patients who, first of all, do you think it's a, theoretically, if those were the numbers and you believe those were the numbers, do you think that would yield a positive risk-benefit ratio for the use of Nevo, even PATHCR? What's the relapse rate after PATHCR?
It's about 5%. It's pretty
5%.
Yeah.
So do you think that these lower risk patients would obtain benefit? And if we knew that, would you offer it?
So I think they could derive benefits simply because of this issue that there are patients with lower risk disease who certainly have micrometastatic disease and who have tumors that are sensitive to immune checkpoint blockade. And then it becomes a numbers game. What's the risk that they're going to have an adverse event for the treatment of a situation where they're already cured surgically? So here again, I think this is where ctDNA potentially is helpful in the future.
And we got a lot of questions about ctDNA from the docs in practice. Of course, they're already used to using it in colorectal or colon cancer. And it sounds like that's kind of maybe the direction you all are maybe going to move in.
So the IMvigor 210 study, this was the similar study to CheckMate 274, but randomized patients to adjuvant atezolizumab versus observation. That study did not show a disease-free survival benefit. The investigators took a look at that study using the Signatera platform, published in Nature, showed that in patients with detectable ctDNA, there seemed to be a benefit from adjuvant atezo, not so much in patients without detectable ctDNA. That's a post hoc analysis that's different than CheckMate 274, which showed a benefit of adjuvant Nevo in the enrolled population, but it certainly establishes some proof of concept for the approach. So that approach is being prospectively validated in a few studies. One is called IMvigor 211, which is enrolling patients, similar patient population. If there is detectable ctDNA, then patients are randomized to adjuvant atezolizumab versus a placebo. And then there's a study that we're getting up and running through the U.S. cooperative group system called MODERN. And in this study, patients with detectable ctDNA are randomized to adjuvant nivolumab versus adjuvant nivolumab plus relatlimab. And patients with undetectable ctDNA are randomized to adjuvant Nevo versus just observation with the initiation of nivolumab if there's conversion from ctDNA negative to ctDNA positive results.
So one of the most common questions we got relates to the next thing I want to ask you about, which is bladder sparing and the avoidance of cystectomy, particularly in older patients. Any comments about how you approach these patients? Of course, a lot of people are asking, what about adjuvant IO, adjuvant Nevo in those patients?
So the adjuvant IO question is a great question. We don't have data. There's a phase two study that looked at the feasibility of a similar paradigm to what's done in lung cancer and stage three lung cancer. Certainly showed the feasibility of giving immune checkpoint blockade after chemo radiation, but we don't have randomized data yet. In terms of just thinking about this space overall, so certainly trimodality therapy, transurethral resection plus chemotherapy plus radiation is a standard treatment for muscle-invasive bladder cancer used throughout the world, some places in the world more than others. In my practice, patients who don't want to proceed with cystectomy, which is not uncommon, and I saw two patients this week who didn't want cystectomy, we proceed with concurrent chemo radiation. The choice of chemotherapy that's added depends a little bit on some patient characteristics, including renal function. Twice weekly gemcitabine is a regimen that we commonly use, and that's been used in some cooperative group studies as well.
Let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease, and we'll start out talking about first-line therapy. Maybe we should even backtrack a little bit and have you comment a little bit about how you look at the issue of cisplatin and carboplatin eligibility and how that leads you in different directions in the metastatic setting.
So in the metastatic setting, we think first about cisplatin eligibility, and cisplatin-based chemotherapy is still a standard of care for patients who can receive cisplatin. One of the reasons for that is that there does seem to be a subgroup of patients who have durable disease control, even in the metastatic setting with cisplatin-based chemotherapy. Criteria that make a patient cisplatin ineligible are somewhat arbitrary, but mostly guided by renal function, creatinine clearance of less than 60. Some people use a little bit lower, but 60 is a commonly used cut point. And then hearing loss, of course, peripheral neuropathy, any history of cardiac dysfunction. So that's what tends to make patients cisplatin ineligible, and in the renal function issue is probably the most common of those. For patients who are cisplatin ineligible with metastatic disease, traditionally carboplatin-based chemotherapy was standard treatment. Now, as of a few months ago, the combination of enfortumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab is approved by the FDA. That's based on a study that randomized patients to enfortumab vedotin alone versus the combination. The combination has quite a high response rate, relatively speaking, for the treatment of metastatic urothelial cancer. About 60 to 70% of patients have a response, and the responses tend to be quite durable. We haven't seen randomized phase three data with that regimen in the frontline setting yet, but that's coming. So that's a standard regimen. This notion of carboplatin ineligible or chemotherapy ineligible is a bit more difficult because this tends to define a population of patients who have comorbidities, who are frail, and for whom the risks versus benefits of systemic therapy at all needs to be carefully considered and discussed. This is a patient population for whom single agent immune checkpoint blockade is commonly prescribed. And certainly from a tolerability standpoint, many patients will do okay with that approach, but single agent immune checkpoint blockade is not, of course, without the risk as well. And so that also requires some careful consideration.
So let's talk a little bit more about the pembro and fortimab combination and what we know about it in terms of risks and benefits. Maybe you could just start with maybe a few words about enfortumab and what it is, what we know about the tolerability issues, and then kind of work your way up to this first-line combination.
So enfortumab vedotin is an antibody-drug conjugate. The antibody is directed against Nectin-4, pretty ubiquitously expressed on urothelial cancer cells, so we don't test for it. It has MMAE linked to it as the payload. This was initially studied in patients with metastatic disease who had progressed despite prior platinum-based chemotherapy and immune checkpoint blockade, had a response rate in that setting of between 30 to 40%. Ultimately, what received accelerated approval and then studied in a phase three study, showed a survival benefit that's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, led to a full approval by the FDA. around the time that those studies were ongoing, there was a multi-arm study studying different enfortumab-based combinations. And one of those combinations was the combination of enfortumab plus pembrolizumab. And that was initially studied in the frontline setting in patients with metastatic disease who are cisplatin ineligible. And in the initial presentation of that data a few years ago, the response rate was 72%. Lots of enthusiasm about that. And that led to this bigger study trying to address the contribution of components. So studied single agent enfortumab as frontline treatment in that population versus the combination. These drugs, of course, have different mechanisms of action. They have different side effect profiles as well, but there are some overlapping side effects. And it's a regimen that takes a little bit of experience in terms of trying to sort out the side effects. So enfortumab vedotin can cause a rash. The rash can range from something that's mild to something that's more severe, can cause some diarrhea, cause peripheral neuropathy. It could actually cause hyperglycemia as well in a small subset of patients. When we give the two together, probably at least in the initial treatment, one of the side effects that can be most difficult to sort out is a rash, which can occur with both drugs.
So I'm just kind of taking a step back, though, in terms of looking at quality of life of people on this combination. First of all, what fraction of patients kind of cruise through no problem?
So the tolerability is quite heterogeneous, and some of those side effects that I described are certainly more cumulative related side effects. So peripheral neuropathy tends not to happen early on, tends to happen later, 4 to 6 cycles of treatment. And then you start running into neuropathy where dose holds and dose delays come into play. And not all patients develop neuropathy, but many patients do. And with enough treatment, most patients will have some neuropathy. The other tolerability issues tend to be a little bit more heterogeneous. So certainly, my guess, 20% of patients sail through it, and then the rest of the patients have some side effects that require management, dose holds, dose delays, or just supportive medicines.
So, when I was looking yesterday at the ASCO paper about chemotherapy shortage, and they put the EV Pembro as an option in patients where situations where you can't access platinum, I was kind of thinking about, what happens? I mean, I think there is a trial doing this. If you were to compare EV Pembro in younger, healthy patients to, chemo, cis-based chemo, followed by avelumab maintenance, what would you see in terms of response rate, in terms of kind of the initial benefits and risk, and what would you see in terms of survival?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And the phase 3 study testing that question has completed accrual. We just haven't seen the results yet. So that phase 3 study enrolled an all-comer population, so patients could receive gem-cis or gem-carbo. So it won't specifically address the cisplatin question, but we will see some of that data.
So, and what about in terms of response rate, chemo, versus EV Pembro?
So with frontline chemotherapy in modern studies, IMvigor 130, Keynote 361, these studies that compared platinum-based chemotherapy with platinum-based chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade, we see response rates with platinum-based chemotherapy in about the 40 to 50% range in those studies. The response rate with EV Pembro in the data that led to approval by the FDA, the response rate was about 68%. And so EV Pembro is a regimen that is associated with a pretty high response rate compared to what we've seen with chemotherapy. Now, those are not randomized data sets. They're cross-trial comparisons. So we'll ultimately see with the randomized data. But I think EV Pembro is certainly a regimen that's active, quite active.
What would you think you would see, or what do you see clinically in terms of, short-term quality of life, chemotherapy versus EV Pembro?
I would say that EV Pembro is probably a little bit more unpredictable than chemotherapy. And that might just be based on what we're used to in terms of managing side effects in the side effects that that we're comfortable with. But I would say, you know, with chemotherapy, we know what to expect in general. With EV Pembro, as we were discussing, some people sail through it. Some people have much more in the way of difficulty.
What about the issue of when you use a chemotherapy, cisplatin-based chemotherapy, what fraction of patients don't end up getting avelumab maintenance, they progress, et cetera, and what fraction of them, you know, don't get second line, don't get an IO?
So, you know, if you look at the, you know, population-based studies or registry studies, et cetera, it's about a 50% drop-off or more from frontline to second-line therapy. So a large subset of patients who initiate first-line treatment for metastatic urothelial cancer do not receive second-line treatment. And that's just the biology of the disease.
You know, it kind of reminds me, we did a webinar the other day on endometrial cancer, and they just had two big phase three trials come out showing chemo plus IO was better than chemo alone first line, and no huge surprise. But, you know, they also saw really good response rates when they use an IO second line with a TKI, lenvatinib pembro. And one of the points that the faculty brought up the other night is the idea of trying to get your, quote, best drug in early. And I think by best drug, they mean, and I think this goes throughout oncology, the hope that you're going to get a home run.
Yep.
Is that a realistic hope in bladder cancer? I mean, I hear cases presented of people who do well for years. Obviously, you see that in lung cancer, although it's more PD-1 level related. But is that a logical idea that the one chance these people have for a long-term benefit is going to be the IO? You just said that they may not get it unless you give it to them up front. Is that a rationale to think about using it up front?
I think that's absolutely true, but I think maybe the difference with bladder cancer and some of the other solid tumors for reasons that we don't totally understand is that this is true also with cisplatin. Cisplatin-based chemotherapy will achieve these outcomes in a small subset of patients as well. And so, you know, getting cisplatin-based chemotherapy followed by switch maintenance immune checkpoint blockade is a really good regimen for many individuals. And of course, the Javelin Bladder 100 data support that. But yeah, I think that what you do first does matter in this disease because we know that the biology is such that some patients only get one shot at treatment.
So I think we can spend the rest of our time talking about the sequencing of therapy and metastatic disease and other issues that come up in metastatic disease. So why don't we bring in the other two major players, sacituzumab and erdafitinib. You kind of provide a little bit of brief on what they are and what we know about them in bladder cancer.
So erdafitinib is a small molecule inhibitor of FGFR3. FGFR3 is mutated in about 20% of patients with muscle-invasive advanced bladder cancer, mutated actually much more commonly in low-grade non-muscle invasive disease. Erdafitinib received approval by the FDA in a single-arm phase 2 study published in the New England Journal of Medicine where patients had received platinum-based chemotherapy and had progressed, had mutations in FGFR3, and were treated with this small molecule inhibitor. Response rate was about 40%, led to accelerated approval. And so the full approval, the conversion strategy was a phase 3 study called THOR. And THOR randomized. THOR actually is an interesting design because it has two different components. But the component that we have the results for so far is a randomization of patients who had received prior immune checkpoint blockade. They could have received two prior systemic therapy regimens, but had to receive prior immune checkpoint blockade. And they were randomized to receive dealer's choice chemotherapy, which could be docetaxel or vinflunine outside of the United States, or erdafitinib. And those results were presented at ASCO this year. You know, the response rate data, which is not the primary endpoint, the response rate data is pretty interesting in that the response rate with chemo was about 12%. The response rate with erdafitinib was about 40%. So pretty big difference in the likelihood of response. And then the PFS and overall survival data also demonstrated a significant benefit with erdafitinib, with a hazard ratio for overall survival of 0.64 for erdafitinib versus chemotherapy. So that really reinforces the prior phase 2 data and reinforces the role of this as a really important treatment for patients with metastatic urothelial cancer. So next generation sequencing to determine if there are FGFR mutations, certainly a standard of care in patients with metastatic urothelial cancer. I tend to do that pretty early on in patients with high-risk muscle-invasive bladder cancer, or in particular in the frontline setting in patients with metastatic disease, because it's you want that information in hand when a decision needs to be made about the next line of treatment, which can be unpredictable, as we discussed.
So I want to ask you also about sacituzumab, but first, can you talk a little bit about your experience with erdafitinib, some of the clinical pearls you pass on to fellows about how to use this challenging agent?
So erdafitinib is a drug that is associated with a different side effect profile compared to a lot of the drugs that we use, even compared to some other kinase inhibitors. Erdafitinib can cause skin and nail toxicity, and particularly the nail toxicity is a bit different than some of the other drugs that we use. And so that requires careful attention, dermatology referrals if available, patients reporting changes in skin and nail early on so that dose holds and dose adjustments can be made. Erdafitinib can cause hyperphosphatemia, and so we monitor the FOS level. There's actually a dose escalation strategy that's been employed in the clinical trials in addition to this phase 3 study that I mentioned. The dosing is 8 milligrams, but based on what happens with the FOS in the absence of other high-grade toxicities, you can escalate to 9 milligrams. I have not done that in clinical practice that I can remember, and most of the time I'm dose reducing, but that is per the package, per the label for erdafitinib. So monitor the FOS, pay attention to the nails, and then ophthalmology referral is important early on. Erdafitinib can cause central serous retinopathy. Patients can get blurriness of vision. That is reversible with withholding the drug, but that is something that needs to be paid attention to.
So let's talk a little bit about sacituzumab. Of course, there's been a big experience with that in breast cancer. We hear a lot of good stories about people responding. What do we know about that in bladder cancer?
So sacituzumab, TROP2 antibody with SN38 as the cytotoxic payload. This was studied in a phase 1 study with multiple tumor types early on, showed activity in urothelial cancer. That led to a phase 2 study with pretty similar design to that I mentioned with enfortumab vedotin, single-arm phase 2 study. Patients had received prior platinum-based chemotherapy. Most patients had received prior immune checkpoint blockade as well. And the response rate in that population was 29%, and that led to accelerated approval of sacituzumab. Sacituzumab has now been studied in a phase 3 study, again, very similar to the enfortumab strategy. Patients with metastatic urothelial cancer that progress on platinum-based chemotherapy and immune checkpoint blockade randomized to sacituzumab versus chemotherapy. That study is completed accrual, but we haven't seen the results of that study yet. We don't have data from clinical trials necessarily of sequencing of antibody drug conjugates. In clinical practice, it's something that we do very commonly. And anecdotally, I've seen patients respond to one and then the other. And the response durations, again, anecdotally, the response durations with sacituzumab, particularly prolonged stable disease, I've been impressed with sacituzumab after enfortumab vedotin.
Any thoughts about, I mean, who knows, maybe enfortumab pembro will be used first line, so this won't be an issue, but any thoughts about where we'll land in terms of what comes first, enfortumab or sassy? I mean, right now, a lot of people are using enfortumab because there's more data. But when you look at, again, response, toxicity, tolerability, any thoughts about what you think might be the best choice in somebody with metastatic disease who hasn't had either agent and is FGFR wild type?
So currently we have level 1 evidence for enfortumab vedotin. We have a survival benefit. And so I think for most patients, that's the right strategy. We don't have the phase 3 results yet for our sacituzumab. If the effect size is similar, then I think it's going to be really a discussion about considering a patient's comorbidities and trying to decide which treatment is the right one to use first.
I'm curious, when you talk to people about getting these antibody drug conjugates, I'm hearing more and more people say, I tell the patients it's really like chemotherapy. Is that what you say to them? Do you use preemptive GI meds, et cetera?
So, yes, I definitely say it's like chemotherapy. I say it's a targeted way of delivering chemotherapy, but it's chemotherapy generally with chemotherapy-like side effects. We use a similar regimen for sacituzumab. We use similar meds that we would use with irinotecan, and with of course, enfortumab vedotin. Those medicines aren't required.
What about sequencing in people with FGFR mutations? Also, is there a difference? I mean, I don't even know if you see fusions with bladder, but I think it's biliary where you see more responses to mutations than fusions, but I don't know. Is that an issue with bladder cancer?
So there are fusions. There are FGFR3 TAC. Three fusions, and then there's another fusion that's a little bit less common. The data's been all over the place a little bit, and in the Thor study and the forest plots, you see the effect size a little bit better for the fusions, but in some prior studies, the response rates were a little bit higher with the mutation. So I think it's a wash so far.
What about sequencing patients who are FGFR positive? That's kind of an interesting and challenging situation. I've even heard people talk about using it before an IO, but how do you think it through?
So I think based on the Thor data, using it after IO certainly is justified. Using it before IO, that's part two of the Thor study. So hopefully we'll see those results sometime within the next year and be able to answer that in an evidence-based way. I find that so in my practice now, generally, for a patient who's cisplatin eligible, cisplatin-based chemotherapy, switch maintenance immune checkpoint blockade, and then I'll use an FGFR inhibitor next if a patient has a mutation. I find that by that point, the switch to an oral drug is welcomed by patients, and certainly it's a drug that has activity and a survival benefit now.
So let's talk about some other sort of novel or experimental approaches. And one thing I want to ask you about, you know, when you were commenting on the fact that some people have prolonged responses to cisplatinum, for some reason my mind flipped right into HR deficient, and I don't know if you see that in bladder. I'm sure there must be some patients. I don't know whether people have looked at whether people with, you know, HR deficient tumors respond better to platinum. But any thoughts about that, and any thoughts about the future, if any, of PARP inhibitors in bladder cancer? I think in the meeting we talked about the study called the Bayou study, looking at durvalumab and olaparib. We were talking about that strategy the other night in endometrial cancer also. Do you think that has a future in bladder cancer?
So HRD mutation is definitely seen in bladder cancer. The mutation that has correlated the most strongly and consistently with platinum sensitivity, with cisplatin sensitivity, is actually a mutation, a gene that's pretty unique to bladder cancer compared to other solid tumors, and that's ERCC2, the nucleotide excision repair gene. So this is sort of fits with the mechanism of cisplatin. And there's been extensive work even making those mutations that are found clinically, introducing them into cell lines, testing for cisplatin sensitivity. It's really robust data supporting these mutations and their association with cisplatin sensitivity. Those occur in probably about 10 to 12% of patients with bladder cancer. We also see BRCA mutations, ATM, et cetera. The data around those in platinum sensitivity is a little bit all over the place, although most of it does support a benefit with cisplatin-based chemotherapy. Currently, we don't use those alterations to decide use of cisplatin-based chemotherapy, but there is some ongoing work to determine whether or not they should play a more prominent role in our treatment selection. PARP inhibitors, the studies with PARP inhibitors, for the most part, in patients who have received prior platinum-based chemotherapy, the data with PARP inhibitors isn't great. And it might be that the resistance mechanisms are pretty similar. There's been one largest study already published, and then we have a second study that's in press now that really didn't show much of a response rate at all. The trials using PARP inhibitors with immune checkpoint blockade in platinum naive patients, I think, is a bit more compelling.
Interesting. Any ongoing studies right now that you're looking to see answer some of those questions?
I think probably the study related to cisplatin sensitivity in HRD mutations and sort of looping back this concept of bladder sparing, that's really a really novel study and a really important study to the field, is a study that's being done through the Alliance. And this is a study where patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer receive gemcitabine and cisplatin. And if there's an HRD mutation in their pretreatment tumor, and they have a complete clinical response to chemotherapy, then they're offered the opportunity not to have a cystectomy and just be monitored after that. So TURBT plus chemotherapy as potentially curative treatment for muscle-invasive bladder cancer harboring HRD alterations. And that study has been going on for several years now, and it's an important one to finish.
That really is exciting. So the last thing I want to ask you about, I feel like more and more, I've been making a joke recently that HER2 is the new MSI high and BRAF, because I feel like I'm talking about it in every solid tumor nowadays and hearing pretty cool stuff too. And you all, that's no exception. So maybe you can provide an overview. What kind of HER2 alterations are seen in bladder cancer? And what we know about some of the newer agents that are getting a lot of attention, of course, trastuzumab deruxtecan, for sure, everybody's talking about that, obviously already approved in several tumors. Also tucatinib, which now is approved in colon cancer. And then this really interesting agent, dasatinib vedotin, which I never even heard of, an anti-HER2 ADC. Can you provide a little bit of an overview of HER2 and where you think that's heading?
Sure. So HER2 mutations are actually pretty common in bladder cancer, and unfortunately, it's been difficult to exploit that. There have been studies with small molecule inhibitors of HER2, and they really haven't shown a lot of activity in bladder cancer, and perhaps it's because of the co-alterations that are present. Targeting HER2 with naked antibodies in the past hasn't been that successful. There have been just a few studies with trastuzumab, didn't work very well. There was a basket study with trastuzumab plus pertuzumab that showed activity in some patients with urothelial cancer, so sort of keeping that notion alive. And so there is a study with tucatinib plus trastuzumab. One of the basket studies includes a basket of patients with urothelial cancer. We haven't seen those results yet. I should have mentioned that amplifications in HER2 occur not so commonly, but in a subset of patients with urothelial cancer. HER2 overexpression has been a little bit more of a complicated issue, because the staining pattern in urothelial cancer is different than gastric cancer and breast cancer. And so the right approach to scoring HER2 expression in urothelial cancer has not been completely well-defined. Of course, we use a different scoring strategy in gastric cancer versus breast cancer based on the sort of membranous nature of the staining and the heterogeneous nature of the staining. And so you can see studies quoting HER2 overexpression in bladder cancer at the protein level, showing that, you know, a third of patients have HER2 3+, and you could show some that show 10% have HER2 3+. So it's a little bit all over the board. Antibody drug conjugates targeting HER2 have looked much more promising in urothelial cancer than some of the other strategies targeting HER2. And we really have probably the most data with this drug that you mentioned, dasatinib vedotin. And that's because dasatinib vedotin was actually first developed in China. And so they did a series of phase 2 studies already in China that have been reported. The response rate so dasatinib vedotin, I should say, is an antibody directed against HER2, but it's not trastuzumab. It's directed at a different epitope, and it has MMAE as the payload. So the same payload is in fortibab vedotin. In patients with metastatic urothelial cancer progressing despite prior platinum-based chemotherapy with HER2 2+ or 3+ overexpression, the response rate's about 40 to 50% in the studies that were done in China. And then in a study combining dasatinib vedotin plus a PD-1 inhibitor, the response rate was 70%, sort of similar to what's seen with EV pembro. And so lots of enthusiasm for that drug. And now there's a big international study looking at DV alone and then DV plus pembro.
And I think they saw benefit in HER2 OnePlus also.
That's absolutely right.
Really interesting. You know, it's interesting when you, I didn't realize that you see more mutations in bladder, but it's interesting because you see the same thing in lung. So breast and GI, they're more overexpression, amplification, but lung and I guess bladder, so maybe there's a smoking connection, who knows? Yeah. So what about TDXD? What do we know about that in HER2-positive bladder cancer?
So studied in a clinical trial where patients received the combination of trastuzumab deruxtecan plus nivolumab, and those patients had progressed despite metastatic urothelial cancer had progressed despite prior platinum-based chemotherapy. And the response rate in that study was about 36%. There seemed to be some relationship between HER2 expression and the response rate, although it was a small study. And so that was really the only data that we had until ASCO, where we see this study with multiple tumor types. And the response rate with single agent therapy seems to be maybe a little bit higher. And certainly there does seem to be this signal of correlation with HER2 expression. So I think this is a drug that has activity in urothelial cancer, certainly warrants further development.
Have you or would you use it if you could access it in a patient who ran out of options in metastatic disease?
I would. And I think one of the reasons why is because the payload is different than the other ADCs that we have. And so for a patient with high HER2 expression, high levels of HER2 expression, who has progressed despite standard therapies, I think it's a reasonable thing to consider.
But you haven't done it?
I have done it.
And I'm going to guess you've seen a response.
Yes.
Yeah, I hear that story in so many different cancers. Somebody was telling me the other day, I think it was actually endometrial cancer, that they got it and the patient responded. So really interesting. Of course, there you have the issue of ILD. I don't know how many patients you've treated, but how do you follow these patients? There's a big debate in breast about, imaging beyond just symptoms. What are you thinking?
Yeah, so I was involved with the combination with trastuzumab deruxtecan plus nivolumab. And of course, in that setting, we were very attuned to it because of the risk for pneumonitis with immune checkpoint blockade as well. So we followed patients very closely with CT and with any symptoms, had a low threshold to get PFTs and refer to pulmonology.
Just kind of curious, I hear a lot of stories we were talking about chemo side effects with ADCs. I hear a lot of stories of those issues with TDXD. Did you see that in your patients?
Yes, there are some more chemo-like side effects.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Galsky, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.